What if this isn't a climate crisis, but the greatest opportunity humanity has had in a long time? Lean Into Clean will explore and discuss with highly esteemed guests on what could be the new spirals for society, sustainability, spirituality, and social harmony. Perhaps we've all lost our way. Lean Into Clean will showcase how we might remember, refocus, and restore the natural ways so we can again live in balance and harmony with life on Earth and all its inhabitants. Welcome to this week's Lean Into Clean. I'm Jarvis Smith. It's UK Health Radio. I tell you what, listening to the birds this morning as I awoke was a really nice sign of spring. So with the spring in my step today, I'm going to skip any news because it's always a bit doom and gloom. I'm going to go straight to our guest. I mean, firstly, because I think this is going to be such a riveting show. This is somebody that has, you know, really push the boundaries when it comes to exploring consciousness, not only outside of themselves, but also on the inside. So I'm going to go straight in. I hope that's all right with you. I hope you're having a lovely Monday and it's going to be a fantastic start to the week. So today on Lean Into Clean, we're stepping right to the frontier of consciousness and technology. My guest is Carl Hayden Smith. He's the Associate Professor of Media at the University of East London, founder of the Museum of Consciousness at Oxford University, and co-founder of the Cyberdelics Nexus. And Carl has raised over 10 million in research funding, delivered more than 300 lectures across 40 countries, and published over 50 academic papers exploring the relationship between technology and the human condition. Now, for the past 8 years, he's also been a participant in groundbreaking DMT and MEO-DMT research at Imperial College London, including EEG and fMRI in the extended DMTX studies. Check this: becoming the first person in the world to sustain all five doses during the pilot phase. I can't wait to get into this. He's now developing something called hyperhumanism, which is reframing technology not as something that replaces us, but as something that amplifies our innate human capacities. This is where science meets mystery, where data meets direct experience, and where the future of human being is being actively explored. Carl, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jarvis. Super excited to be on your show. And I know we've been talking for a while, but here we are.
Yeah, here we are. It's funny because Carl and I know each other. We actually happened to meet at an event in Portugal where we were both on the speaker stage and we instantly connected. Carl, I must say, you are also an ambassador, as am I. So shout out to Michelle and Maria from Om. It's great to have another ambassador on the show. But when you hear back that kind of bio, Carl, is there anything in there that you wish was in there or anything that's missing?
Well, as always, Jarvis, I mean, I always feel like I'm just scratching the surface, both of my what it means to be a human being, but also what it means to have a bit of legacy and to contribute not just to the next five generations, but the next 50 generations. So I'm always like a kid in a toy shop or a sweet shop, just constantly thinking about what I can do to really push, you know, not only my individual consciousness, but to elevate consciousness generally, because that's the thing I'm most interested in. I think it's our birthright to explore our own consciousness and to report back what we find, because I know a lot of people are kind of told, you know, that these things shouldn't be discussed, that they should be kept personal, that you shouldn't really shout from the rooftops about the discoveries. But I think at a time like we're all entering, or the time that we're certainly in, it's really important to talk about this and to be encouraging people to explore their consciousness rather than doom scroll or just Netflix themselves to death. Because It's very easy to do that now. We're very much in the distraction farm. We're all on the farm. And it's just a question of how much you realize that and how much you realize. I mean, there was that brilliant graph that I saw recently, which is we live for about 1,000 months. If you're lucky enough to reach your 80s, and we spend a third of that asleep, we spend a third of that at work and at school. Quite a lot of time on the toilet and doing our ablutions and getting ready for the day. And we have about 300 months left of our own time where we're not doing chores. And we spend all of that time on screens. All of that time is spent on our phones. So unless you realize that and break away from that and go a different path or at least explore your consciousness, drop into consciousness, even if it's just 5 minutes a day. I mean, I know you have your own practice. But so many people don't, and they live on autopilot. And your brain, unfortunately, is a prediction machine. So if it knows what's coming, it doesn't wake up. It stays offline. And I think that understanding the basis, understanding your physiology, your biology, and understanding what is an appropriate thing to do, considering our human condition, that's really where I'm at with my sort of perspective.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love it. I'm going to get into the question of consciousness, but I absolutely agree with you. And I think that, upon, deep study of the spiritual ways of mysticism, it's been very, very clear to me that people are not only addicted to screens, but they're also addicted just to the outside world, like the relationship when your eyes are open and you're interacting with that. And what's been lost is this kind of inner relationship. But we're going to dive into that because you've done a lot of deep explorative work. But let me just ask you, Carl, in your perspective, what is consciousness? Bearing in mind you're well studied in this, and why does it matter right now in a technological age?
Well, I'll answer the first. I mean, the first part of the question is the biggest part of any kind of exploration. What is consciousness? But I think we can look at consciousness from multiple perspectives, and that's what I'm really trying to do with a golden thread of consciousness. So, I'm a cognitive scientist by trade. 30 years looking at how we use technology to learn, and how we use technology to either dull our consciousness or awaken our consciousness. I think. At a time like we're in with AI going exponential, and so many people I know that are suddenly, not necessarily needing or feeling like they're needing to contribute to society anymore. They've got their AI assistant, and their AI assistant holds all of human knowledge, because remember, we made the AI. I think that's also forgotten quite a lot of the time. A lot of people are thinking that it's conscious. And a consciousness is emergent. So I'm very much of the opinion that we shouldn't confuse computing with consciousness. I think that consciousness, however, is at the base level of our reality. I think I'm much more of a idealist in that sense, that I think consciousness is fundamental and everything emerges from consciousness. So then you could say AI is emerging from consciousness. Whether it's conscious, though, is another matter. But what I worry about and what I see is AI psychosis happening very rapidly. See a lot of people very upset this week because ChatGPT 4.0 has been taken out of the system. When OpenAI initially tried to do that, they had so many objections, so many people threatening suicide, that they brought it back. But now, for whatever reason, they've decided to terminate it. And a lot of people depended on that particular model because it was the most human, you could argue, the most empathetic. And a lot of people had never had a voice like that in their lives. They'd never had a friend that they could tell anything to without judgment. And on the other side of the coin, a lot of people thought it was very sycophantic and it would only tell you what you wanted to hear. So, but what I'm witnessing is, a lot of people becoming very dependent, not feeling like they need to speak to actual humans anymore, because they feel like they're getting everything they need from that one interface. And this is partly why I've Started exploring hyperhumanism because I think that we don't even know what we are as humans. We don't know the origin story of our own species. You know, a lot of people don't realize that we are half bacteria and we're covered in fungi. So we're much more like an interbeing or three queendoms wandering around, interacting with each other. So if we don't know our own origin story, how can we operate? How can we even come to the question of what is consciousness if we
It's so true.
don't understand our own like origin? So I think that it's really important that we kind of really look at the human project and realize that it's not over, as a lot of you know, the transhumans or the post-humans believe. I think we're just scratching the surface of our potential, and I think that we don't realize that we may have 30 plus senses, not five. How many people realize that, let alone are utilizing that? And the more we engross ourselves in intelligence and focus on intelligence rather than wisdom, rather than empathy, rather than compassion, because there's so much more to us than just intelligence, but that's the fine channel, the narrow channel that we've been pushed towards, saying that this is the most important thing because of the cult of productivity, because of the cult of the individual, because we must all be, you know, tending to our own gardens, not realizing the interconnected nature of life, and that we are in this web of being. And yeah, so for me, it's very much around, you find out what consciousness is through being conscious, through being in the world. You don't find out necessarily what is consciousness by sitting in front of your screen, talking to something that's collaging all of human knowledge that does a very good job of mimicking empathy, intelligence, sentience. But I think it's it's a slippery slope. And I think that, you know, for me, I've been exploring consciousness either through the psychedelic realms, the cybernetic realms, you know, the sound realm, because I think you and I both share the power of sound as a way of immediately dropping into consciousness. And so I don't like to define what is consciousness. I like to practice it. I like to experience it. I like to explore it. And in some ways, I don't really want to solve the mystery of the hard problem of consciousness, because I think it's about enjoying the journey and not saying this is the answer.
Yeah, great. Love it. Love it. Love it. And that's a really, really, wonderful perspective. I'm loving that you mentioned the word psychedelics in there, because that's really what I want to, so much I could talk to you about, but I really want to home in on this psychedelic and DMT experience. But we'll come to that in a minute. But just tell me, there's a lot of cultural hype around psychedelics. What in your opinion, or even actually as a professor, what is the real scientific question that, somebody like Imperial College is trying to answer with psychedelics? Because you've just touched upon, maybe it's an exploration, but where do psychedelics come into it, and what is it trying to achieve?
Well, the reason I was very lucky and blessed to be part of that research is because it was trying to answer the first question that you asked me, what is consciousness? It was very much specifically focused on healthy volunteers, on experienced psychonauts that, you know, could be pushed further into their, what Vygotsky calls the zone of proximal development, so to bring a sort of a cognitive science bent to, or a tilt to that exploration. If you're extremely relaxed, you can be pushed further into complexity of your whatever the learning is. That's your zone of proximal development. If you're stressing out, or if you've got a lot of baggage going in, because psychedelics are non-specific amplifiers, they will amplify what's there in your subconscious. And we all have our shadow sides. We all have our you know, our 360 views. But it's a case of how can you go into a deep meditative state whilst being pushed into an fMRI scanner and be injected with one of the strongest psychedelics known to man, and still be useful for gathering data. I think that that's partly it. But also, yeah, what is consciousness, and can we understand what consciousness is through exploration of this molecule that is very widely spread? You know, it is something that's very simple in its constitution, and we are still exploring it. A lot of people are exploring it individually. A lot of people are exploring it in ceremonies, and now we're exploring it in an extended state. So I think that what I'm fascinated by and what led, it wasn't possible at the beginning of my 8-year journey, but in recent times, what we've actually been using is this DMT extended state. So if you imagine going in for surgery and having an anesthetic pumped into your vein, and you have to have a continuous infusion of anesthetic because you don't want to wake up in the surgery. And now what's happening is they're swapping out the anesthetic for DMT, and you're having a continuous infusion of DMT. And what we showed, or Chris Timmerman showed in his study that I was part of at Imperial, was that it was actually safe to do this procedure, because you do have a sort of, it is abrupt in the sense that any DMT experience is abrupt, but your heart regulates, you start, your physiology starts to calm down, and you can stabilize in that state. And now DMTX studies are happening all over the world. There's been a 6-hour low dose continuous infusion of patients that have been suffering from being in comas and suffering from strokes. So, and there's all sorts of work going on around how DMT, if you're receiving a DMT infusion post heart attack or post stroke, you're much more likely to survive in the ambulance on the way to the hospital unscathed in terms of damage. So that's the kind of reason. Those are the sorts of use cases that I thought this is worthy of being a participant, to see how we can push this forward, how we can understand what's going on where when this extraordinary substance is given to you in a larger dose than you would normally have it.
Amazing, amazing. I'm guessing there's probably a lot of people that are listening right now that won't even know what DMT is. So I want you to give me a very quick kind of analysis or overview of what DMT is. Before we do that, we're going to just quickly go to a commercial break because I don't want to spoil or split up what you're going to be telling us. So don't go away, everyone. We're going to find out more about DMT. Carl Hayden Smith is an absolute expert, hugely respected around the world for his experiments. I'm not sure if you call it that, his trials maybe. So we'll come back to Carl and find out a bit more about DMT and actually what happens when you go into that state. So don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back. I'm here with Carl Hayden Smith. We're just about to get into some of his well, his journeying in this using this psychedelic called DMT. Carl, just tell us, what is DMT? Because I understand if we recall conversations with you before that we produce this naturally, right? It's something that's around us all the time. But just give us a bit of a deeper explanation, please.
Yeah, sure. So DMT is a naturally occurring psychedelic compound of the tryptamine family. It's often referred to as the spirit molecule, and it acts as a fast-acting serotonin receptor agonist, which produces intense short-acting hallucinations. So you may ask me next, what is a serotonin receptor agonist?
I was just about to.
So that's a substance that activates serotonin receptors in the brain and body, mimicking the effects of natural neurotransmitter serotonin. So it is closely related to serotonin, which is why it's a simple molecule. But we know DMT is found in very many, many, many plants and many animals, including potentially humans. There's a lot of rat studies. We are doing our own endogenous DMT research at New Nautics with University of Florida right now. And that's working with Andrew Gallimore and co. So yeah, there's lots of myths David Nichols, in his paper, I believe in 2015, but you know, busted a lot of those myths. But urban myths tend to linger on. You know, we found, or Chris Timmerman found, that when he basically analyzed the data from the subjects in the early DMT work, that it looks like your brain is in a sleeping or dreaming state whilst on DMT. So whether there is a relationship between dreaming and DMT is up for grabs. But also, David Nichols said that a lot of people say, you know, that DMT is produced in the brain, but again, we don't know. It may be produced in the lungs, it may be produced across the body, but there is some evidence that it's released at death. Again, it's difficult to actually understand that without actually having somebody, you know, being analyzed whilst dying. So these things, again, there's lots of ethical questions around how do you measure these things. But yeah, that's why it's such an interesting area to actually be exploring and to try and unravel what's happening in these mechanisms. And I know Chris has recently done, so there's a big difference between DMT, which is NN-DMT, which is your Changa, your ayahuasca, your crystal DMT, and 5-MeO-DMT. And 5-MeO-DMT is a completely different strength and class of drug. It's a whole, you know, league above in terms of the effects, in terms of intensity. And one of the things Chris did recently was actually, and it got widespread coverage in New Scientist, for instance, you can check this out, where he compared, you know, a Tibetan Buddhist meditator with 5-MeO-DMT. So I think they were given 5-MeO-DMT and then asked, is this the same as what you're experiencing in your highest state of meditation? So I'm not going to give you the punchline on that, but you know, there are parallels here that people are reaching these sorts of states in a natural way. And that's, for me, where my greatest interest lies. How do we reach these states on our own supply without the need for anything in addition? But of course, we're in a culture where people don't generally want to do the work or don't have time to do the work. Another example there would be lucid dreaming. There is a protocol where you can learn how to lucid dream, but it takes work. You're reality testing every sort of 3 or 4 times a day. You'll look at your hand and go, am I dreaming? Eventually you'll start looking at your hand in your dreams, and you may notice one finger longer than the other, and then you'll realize, without shocking yourself into waking up, you'll realize you're actually dreaming. And then you can start lucid dreaming and start to actually explore that context. And now there may be technologies that come in that enable us to have lucid dreaming on demand, which is much more a transhuman perspective, where we just press a button and we get this skill or we get this ability without the need for the hyperhuman work. But always, I think we will benefit from doing it on ourselves without the intervention of technology. And not to say that I haven't opened up areas of my mind with these substances. And I think once you've opened them, you can revisit them. And one of the most interesting parts of being in the Imperial study was the music that we were listening to on each journey. And it was the same track over 8 years that I was being played as I was listening to, as I was going into a DMT space. So now all I need to do is put that track on in order to have a DMT experience, because it's so imprinted on my consciousness.
Yeah.
That I'm so associated with that state space that I can go there without the need for the DMT. So I think that's the thing. If you have an experience, it opens up that new part of your experiencing, your brain, then that door's open and you can enter that door as often as you want with the right contextual information gathered. Like, I think that's why context is so important, and why I started thinking about context engineering as far back as 2014, because I think context engineering, as opposed to content engineering, I think we are entering a new realm of context, the context economy, I call it, because if you think about a psychedelic experience, it's completely dependent on the contextual factors. And that could be your mind state, your body state, as my friends Malin and Jack Alocca have written a paper recently that was picked up by Brian Johnston. Body state is critical. So how well have you slept the night before? Have you fasted? Have you eaten? Have you had a virus in the last few weeks? Because all these things will affect your journey, and also, of course, your environment. And one of the big things about the context engineering at Imperial is that they tried, they had music specifically produced for these journeys. They pimped out the rooms, even though you kind of know, and it's very difficult for your brain to unknow that you're in a hospital ward where people may have died, even in the same day that you're then tripping in the same space. You associate hospitals with death and dying. So almost all the clinical trials data that we have may well be skewed according to that philosophy. So I think context is 80% of the medicine. A lot of people agree with me. So I'm really excited about what we're doing in the Caribbean, where we now have an opportunity to legally do DMTX journeys in the best possible context. So check out EluciousMind. .com. That's our project there, and what we're trying to achieve there is really doing these experiments in nature. Imagine the scene: you have a light breakfast, you go swimming on the barrier reef, you come back and you have a long massage, and then you go in and have a DMTX experience where the dose could be controlled. So if you think about an ayahuasca journey is like you take your one, two, three cups, and you're in for the journey. There's no escape from what you've taken. But with DMTX, because you're having a continuous infusion, the technology enables us now to control the dose. So you may just want to go in at a very low dose, say, 5 milligrams, and just stay there for the whole time, just to get used to the space. If you do come across some interesting geometry, you could turn up the dose to 20 or 40 or 60 milligrams, depending on how much of a psychonaut you are, and then have this experience with an entity. Go in there with a specific intention. Say you're a scientist and you want to solve some sort of problem. See if you can have this kind of this collaboration with hyperspace, with whatever we want to call it. But there's been a lot of psychedelic discoveries made whilst under the influence. And so I'm really interested in, how can we turn this into a technology that will enable us to advance our humanity, but also solve some of the biggest problems that we know we have. And I think that, we talk about, AI entities, AI consciousness, but I think there is, I would much, much rather explore consciousness in the entity space than in the technological space. But what's interesting is that we know these things also can potentially help people, like I said, that have had strokes, that have been in comas, to recover. So it's a double whammy. It's not only just exploration to solve this hyper object. You may have heard of hyper objects. Hyper objects are problems that can't necessarily be solved by individuals. They're too vast, like climate change. I know this is close to your heart. So it needs this wider investigation. And so we're inviting scientists, we're inviting mathematicians, we're inviting shamans, we're inviting the indigenous to really explore this space in a way that we can control the contextual factors. And my role there is head of context engineering. So I've gone from theorizing about it to now actually doing it in the world. And I think that context engineering will be a new role. We've seen that term go viral in AI now because people are moving away from prompt engineering. Prompt engineering is officially dead, according to many, many perspectives. Because if you're wanting to get the best out of an LLM, you need to give it as much contextual information as possible. And it's just like a psychedelic journey. You need to focus on the contextual information as much as possible for the best result.
Nice, nice. And for those of you that are interested, Carl mentioned Eleusis Mind. It's Eleusis Mind.com. So if you do want to go and check it out, you feel drawn to explore in this, which sounds amazing, by the way, doing it in that kind of, you know, tropical island state is, it's funny. I always ask a question when I'm doing a talk. I always say to people, close your eyes and take yourself to the place that brings you the most joy, or the place that brings you the, you know, the happiest. And, you know, 99% of the time people are in nature, often on a beach, you know, often, you know, with waves washing up, and it's kind of, you know, that seems to be the happy place. So you're getting the best of both worlds there. Brilliant. I love it. Love it. Are you able to share anything on your personal experiences, or is there a theme that runs through when people have a DMT experience? Is there something that you could share for people to get a taste of what happens?
Of course, and I can only ever speak from my own perspective, but I'm very much experiencing all sorts of different motifs that are repeated. I, for instance, have a signer at the bottom of my, if you call it a screen, if you like, I experience a signer that's literally giving me a thumbs up or a thumbs down while I'm while I'm consuming the DMT, as wow. If to say, go on, do more, do more, do more, do more, and then once you've hit the right dose, it's like stop.
Okay.
No, stop. Like a guide, basically. That's just like you would see on a TV, that's sort of translating, you know, for the.
And how does that appear in your mind's eye, in your thoughts, in your feelings?
It's a visual. It's a visual experience. It's always a female presence, and it's almost it's very encouraging and just, you know, I know a lot of people experience, you know, quite difficult you know, entity encounters and stuff, but I always have that if you call it an entity or a guide, it's always there, no matter what else is going on in the scene. So another thing I'll always see is language at the core of my screen, if you like. The space that I'm in will be this hieroglyphic ancient and modern language that's not flat, but it is, you know, because we seem to have more dimensions of space in these realms. I will see this holographic language writ large, which I've never been able to draw, because again, at Imperial, it was quite strict protocol, blindfolded, not really able to do anything, even though I know I could have been drawing what I'm seeing, and the best time to do it is during. Again, that's one thing we'll be able to do in the Caribbean, is really open up the exploration and the ways that we can bring back the information that we're gathering. But I'm seeing this language, and it's consistent. It's always there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm just fascinated as to how we can translate that. But it's made of light. Everything's made of light in that space. And the way I explain that is that we are experiencing, in this dimension, we're having the light shine upon us. The sun is shining upon us. In, you know, the DMT space, it seems to be everything is light bodies. Like if you even look down at your own body, you have a light body. You're emitting light, mm-hmm. and you know, this also equates to what we may say is, you know, that when we have dreams, we're in the astral realm, or we have a light body. And even when people talk about abduction, you know, alien abduction, it's not necessarily your physical body that's abducted; it's your light body. Mm-hmm. Lots of parallels there. And when you do 5-MeO DMT, it's again a completely different relationship with light, because you become light itself. There's no longer any form or subject object relationship. It's just you as infinite eternal light, which seems like godly, you know. It seems like you're at the source of all formless form. So my hunch is that there's also negative dimensions of light, and you know, we know that the Kogi tribe, for instance, in Colombia, they choose their shaman very early on before birth, and then they, when they're born into darkness, and they stay in the dark, in the caves for 9 or 18 years in complete darkness, where their endogenous DMT levels, nobody's studied this yet, but you know, we know from people going into darkness retreats, even for 8 days, and some people do 17 days, some people do longer, you know, that their DMT levels seem to be elevated because they're tripping balls. I remember talking to Aubrey Marcus about this, and he said, you know, completely sober, his 8-day complete darkness retreat, he was having his strongest psychedelic journey, and he's very experienced with DMT. Mm. One of the studies we want to do at New Nautics, and one of the studies, again, we're working with Malin and Jack on is, free diving. And if there's a relationship between going into a free dive, and I know Malin, when I first met her, she had a phobia of the water, but now she's almost at an Olympic level free diver after working and you know, training in Dahab in Egypt. So whether, you know, breath work, free diving, darkness, we may discover that all of these produce endogenous DMT. And again, we're, you know, at New Nautics, newnautics.org. This is really a not-for-profit to explore psychedelic discovery. And, you know, we're doing it in as humble way as possible, because who knows the true answers to a lot of these questions. They're very difficult to study. But we're having a crack at it, and we're having a lot of fun along the way.
amazing. We're gonna have to go to our second commercial break, but when we come back, Carl, I'm gonna ask you to play one of the songs that you've chosen for this show. But don't go away, guys, we're gonna come back, we're gonna find out more about Carl and the journey of the DMT. ME, what is it, what is it, MEO?
We're talking about NN-DMT, so it's dimethyltryptamine. And 5-MeO-DMT is the other one we've been talking about.
5-MeO-DMT, thank you. Okay, don't go away. We'll be back with Carl shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back. I'm here with Carl Hayden-Smith. We're talking about the psychedelic journey of DMT, prolonged exposure to DMT. Carl, actually, through the experiments that have happened, has done the longest time under the influence of DMT, certainly up until this point. It sounds like experiments are increasing around the world now, Carl, but do you still kind of hold that record?
It's not about the longest time. It was that particular record was doing the full 5 doses.
The doses. Got it.
Of the pilot. So we were really trying to understand what's the appropriate dose to give people in the main study. So it was a bit of a challenge, but also just extraordinary because, it was really the first proper recorded study of DMTX, and a real privilege to be part of it, and but not for the faint-hearted, for sure. it's something that you really need to, I considered, it was a 3-month journey, and it was very strict. Like I came off, you weren't allowed to consume other drugs whilst in that time. And I went completely off alcohol. I stopped even caffeine.
Yeah.
And I think that was actually really a really beautiful thing to just, as Chris and I called it, DMT church, mm-hmm. to go to church and to really just, like any dieter, to really explore DMT and to live it and to to try and acquaint yourself with something that is so sacred.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to do it on my birthday. I did it on my dad's birthday. You know, we could talk all day about the kinds of experiences I've had in there, but it answered some extremely profound questions. And I think it does help with understanding the, you know, both the living and the dying of our existence. And I think that that's why it's such a privilege. And, you know, I was very lucky to go in and have zero anxiety. I know a lot of people struggle with it, but I tend to experience these things from a non-dual perspective. I was very, very lucky to try 5-MeO-DMT first before DMT. And somehow that really helped, because once you experience, you know, a full non-dual realm, you know, everything's coming from that realm. And therefore you can cope with all the entities and all the things that arise as phenomena within that non-duality, rather than giving over to or giving agency over to these things and calling them demons or angels. I think it's all from source. It's all for learning. I think we're in a learning lab here. You know, and we've been again together to Egypt to explore some of the extraordinary mysteries of our human brothers and sisters. And it's fascinating to see that, you know, when you go to the Serapeum, for instance, and you see these 100-ton boxes and they're in these tiny little spaces, and you know now that it would take 500 men to move them. And you know, going into the Great Pyramid and doing these sound experiments and trying to understand if sound has been used as a technology that we've now lost. And that's again the Museum of Consciousness, a project that I started 5 years ago now, to really just go into what McLuhan calls the cold media. You know, we're obsessed, we're overrun with like hot media, which is your CGI films and your games. But if you can just go into your radio show where you're filling in the visuals, or your books where, again, you're co-creating the outcomes and the way it individually falls to you as a reader, I really wanted to just give sound its true, you know, to give it its true respect. Because I think so much of the time now we don't listen to sound in the foreground. We listen to it in the background. We listen to it on our phones. We listen to it in ways that it was never intended to be listened to. Even on Spotify, we're listening to very, you know, MP3, lossy quality, you know, recordings. It's not as emotional as the artist would have wanted. But to go to Egypt, to actually play the temples, to actually you know, work together in terms of toning together and really creating this communitas in these Beyond the Gates tours is for me a privilege. And I think, you know, I absolutely, and I encourage all of my friends who come to these trips or come to a Museum of Consciousness to stay sober and to try and get high on your own supply in those contexts.
I love it. I absolutely did. Yeah, we'll talk about that. But as we're on the subject of music, we're coming, we've got about 12 minutes to the end of the show, so we need to try and get some songs in. But you've chosen a song. Do you want to just tell us the name of it? Which, in fact, you know, whichever one you'd like to play. But I think we agreed. You tell us what song we're going to play.
So this is a record that my dear friend Danny McLuhan, who's an amazing sound architect. I was very lucky to buy some of his records not that long ago, and this was the pick of the bunch. The track's called Eternity, and yeah, for me, it is one of those things that transforms consciousness, and I'm very grateful it was on Spotify, so I know we had to have it on Spotify. But if you can get a copy on CD where it's full resolution, then I highly recommend it. But the dynamic range here, the, you know, instant impact on what it says on the tin, because it does feel like you're going into an altered state with this track.
So this is by a gentleman called Hari Prasad Chaurasia, and this is called Eternity. Thanks, Carl. Let's play this, and we'll be back, Carl, very soon. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful piece of music. It reminds me of my dream last night, funnily enough. It was Mahashivratri last night, which is the day that mystics believe is the day that you are able to really push yourself, elevate your consciousness. It's like the day of the year that where you're able to elevate your consciousness tenfold. So many people sit upright all through the night. I sat up for a while, and I remember having a dream about India, and I was distraught that I wasn't back in India. So that brought back nice memories, that song. What does it do for you, that music? Is that one of those songs that would take you back to that DMT experience?
I mean, this would be exactly the kind of track that we would love to have played live at the Museum of Consciousness. I mean, it's got everything in it for me. It's all about what's in between the notes. You
Yeah.
know, that's the trick. And I mean, what a musician. I mean, I need to explore all of his other records, but that one gets a lot of plays. And of course, when you buy records from India, they're all heavily played. They're not like they're not kept on the shelves. So
Yeah, yeah. Well, just so you know, everyone is listening, if you like that, it's a 20-minute piece of music. So obviously we weren't able to play it all, but you can get it on Spotify. So we'll do that. And let's talk about Museum of Consciousness quickly, Carl. We've literally got 6 minutes to the end of the show. So you can decide, are we going to play your second song, or should we talk more about, stuff that's going on in your world? It's entirely up to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why it's important to play the second song is because to pay homage to Spongle, because Spongle, you may know, actually produced an album called The Museum of Consciousness, which I didn't actually know about until after I'd started my project. But again, I would love to invite them to the Museum of Consciousness, knowing that they've created that album. But this album is special. It's I mean, it's for me an extraordinary improvisation, which again, the Museum of Consciousness is very much about me going out, being a scout, having something that moves me at a festival or a party, and really just trusting the artist to then change consciousness again for a live audience, generally at Oxford or around the world. I mean, we did a show, as you know, in Bolivia to trees and plants and animals as part of OM, and really trying to understand what the impact of sound is. And again, it's one of the hardest things. It's a lot of the things that I'm doing are all related in the sense that it's extremely hard to understand a psychedelic experience because everyone is different. Everyone brings a different something different to the party. And I'm really just fascinated by the effects of sound and how one sound could be, an amazing for one person, but not at all for another. But yeah, I think this particular track, Spinach Tooth by Simon Posford and Raja Ram, was actually a record that arrived to my friend Gregory Sams. And Gregory Sams basically, he wanted me to turn the vinyl into digital because he doesn't have a record player at home. And I discovered some art that Roger had made inside the record, which I then told Greg about. But it's great to pay homage to such musicians, and it's an improvisation flute and piano. And it's just one of the most moving tracks I've heard recently. And in terms of the Museum of Consciousness, I think that this project is very needed. I think the long form nature of it, so we'll do 4 or 5 hour shows to a live audience, and we will get people to close their eyes. So people shut their eyes, they go into their own imaginations, they're fully encouraged to do so. And the challenge to the artist is, can you change consciousness just with sound in a 20-minute piece? And it's really tough. I mean, we know that sound changes consciousness generally, but what we're trying to do is create sound that changes consciousness reliably across cultures, across genders, across age groups, and pieces that are worthy of being in a museum. And of course, it's a challenge to the artist, and I want it to be something that inspires them. And eventually what I want to do is create a sound hospital, So to move from a sound, museum of sound to an actual sound hospital where you can go and get a prescription of sound. And again, going back to Egypt, we know in Saqqara there is a sound hospital that's 5,000 plus years old. So these things aren't new. There's nothing new under the sun, as they say. But yeah, what really is the power of sound? And we know certain sounds can kill cancer cells, certain frequencies. But we also know that there's a huge amount of pseudoscience in the space. So how do we navigate that pseudoscience and all the rest of it? But I think we've got time to play the track now.
We have, Carl. Thank you for that. I had a slight technical hitch here, so thank you for holding the space. So we're
No
going to
problem.
play. This is Spinach Tooth. We got literally a minute to get this in, Carl. It's been a pleasure having you with us. Thank you very much. If you want to check out Museum of Consciousness, you can. This track, Spinach Tooth, by Simon Posford, Raja Ram, Schwongel. Thank you very much. Have a lovely week. We'll see you next week. Cheers, Carl.
Cheers, mate.